Blog Talk Radio.
This is Masonic Effects, and it's a pleasure to have you. We're going to continue on with the traditions of past years. This really starts, we've just passed the fifth anniversary of Masonic Home Companion, which evolved last year into Masonic Effects. Ever striving to keep up with the new, I think you're going to enjoy the program this week. Lots of things happening around the world, which are enormously distracting. But I think since you and I are of a more reflective nature, we can easily agree that the winter solstice has brought a welcome relief from the tedium of the fall. Now we're into winter, this being the 10th day of Christmas. I'm going to talk about that. Well, why don't I play a little bit of that right now? Here. The 10th day of Christmas comes from the carol that's sung around this time of year. You know, our holiday season that we know as Christmas is a continuation of Saturnalia. It goes back to ancient Roman festivals, to the festivals of Saturn in December, and it was great, the parties and carrying on, and it was to honor the deity Saturn. It was held on the Julian calendar on the 17th of December, and then it really increased through to the 23rd of December. Now, interesting that some want to know about origins, and I think this was more like most great ideas. An increased awareness built on some occurrences going on and the imagination of people of the day. I think of invention as pulling together a whole bunch of parts and then crediting one moment or one person with a discovery. And, I used to think that I was told that Edison had invented light bulbs. I find that's not true. But he was better at marketing and a more ambitious businessman. And laws were a little looser about plagiarism and what have you, and nationalism being what it is. If you say a person is the discoverer long enough, some people will just begin to believe it. Like Amelia Earhart is not necessarily the greatest female aviatrix of her time, but the most widely publicized. And still, these are people that are pivot points, little touchstones in our memories and throughout history. So they serve a very honorable and useful purpose. Now, 12 Days of Christmas goes something like this, just as we're in the 10th day of Christmas. So as you and I start our new calendar year, just have a listen as we fade to black with our Christmas celebrations. Here it is.
On the 10th day of Christmas, might you look into me? Trembled the leaping nine, leading dancing feet, made the milking sun, swung the swimming fish, keep the laying fine, golden ring. Boy calling birds, three French hen, two turtle doves, and the partridge in a pear tree.
You've got the idea. There was a period, this comes from a time when there was a cultural clarity taken for granted by the people of the day, but it wasn't necessarily based on tradition, it was based on convention. What was happening in and around the place. Even when when we acknowledge we're coming up to the 300th anniversary of the United of the Grand Lodge of London, I think it was originally United Grand Lodge, witch trials had were still in the minds of people, although reform was putting an end to the death sentences and hangings and burnings. Very much we see a presence of superstition in the minds of people of the day. And as it would be unusual for us to assume that all superstition no longer rules the thoughts or influences the thoughts of people around us, but that's that's not the case. We are still a superstitious lot. People unfamiliar to us, or people with strange habits or ways of dress are a threat. That's a more popular superstition. Time to keep a level head, not to jump onto the wagon at once. Us to voice our baser instincts toward our fellow man. When we see that there are people living in desperate situations, 7 or 8 million people moving refugees around the face of the earth, it's no time for smugness. It's a sad commentary on the human condition. And the challenge for us is to behave as we have been talking. Are we truly invested in our fellow man? Or are we just satisfying our own egos, that our version of xenophobia or nationalism is the accepted one and all the rest are wrong? Freemasonry does hold you and I to a higher standard. And I think at the as we ponder the development of Freemasonry, it's a very odd process, is this thing that we call Freemasonry. But it's also something that's endured for reasons that are, I think, reflective of the dilemma that's posed by Freemasonry. We have done a very poor job, I will say, on behalf of my outlook on life and Freemasonry. We have done a very poor job of taking the narrative to the membership. There are a few areas that are obvious, that where we truly embarrass ourselves as a group of thoughtful men. We can hardly stumble over ourselves with a rather boyish explanation of the misogyny that Masonry is accused. The fact that this version of Freemasonry is not in any sense the epitome of Freemasonry. Freemasonry exists beyond the constitution of a single constitution when we look at things globally, which we can do and are doing. And it's presenting us with questions based on the different perspective that we have now. Our narrative is very almost childlike or naive. And certainly, I think we can agree that it leaves us wanting. And yet the scene around us isn't accelerating. Our perception as we age is that things are accelerating. But life moves at its own pace, neither quicker nor slower. It's us, it's our perception that changes. So we have some work to do that lies before us. And I think if I'm going to be generous to the order, I can say that we've needed certain elements around us within Freemasonry to line up. The lament of Freemasonry, I think, is part of the task. We offer it in a very simplistic way that Freemasonry provides answers, but to essential questions. This notion of making a good man better, for some men, it's don't have the capacity. Is referred to in simplistic terms, but to allow that to dominate the narrative or the conversation is a mistake. Freemasonry is not a cookbook of reality. It's not a pop psychology version of answering the unanswerable. It's not Life for Dummies. It's a process of self-discipline, which, if followed, may enlighten the participant. The inability of Freemasonry to offer this as a guarantee is because of a primary ingredient in that equation, that the outcome is largely dependent on the knowledge and ability of the individual and their desire. Now, that's beautifully written in terms of our history. Think about the mystery cults that are referred to in Masonry as the foundation. Now, to say that Freemasonry has its foundations or connections with ancient Egypt or the pre-Christian period, it's valid if we're going to say that the bottle of corked wine, that the tree that grows in the forest in South America, the cork tree, is relevant to the bottle of corked wine that sits on my my table at dinner. It's a loose correlation. Just as saying that, the sun has relevance on that bottle of wine, because it was necessary for the growth of the tree, that the cork tree, you know, it was necessary for the growth of the grapevines and the yeast. And, you know, we, so we're making sort of associations in our mind, and that have a bearing, but rather insignificant bearing, I would say. One of the more startling reasons that we're able to bring forward my history is that we have supported the work and the objectivity of the historian. We've no longer begun to sanitize history to serve our ideas. In other words, we don't just agree with a history that agrees with us. We're able to, we have the ability to change our mind, to change our point of view based on fact. Fact is something redeemable that has some degree of consistency until it is disproven. Now, for people that are determinists, that can be a tragedy. That can be the person that is whose balance, whose moral rudder depends on permanence, needs to really, I think, re-examine the whole idea of permanence. In an existence where everything around us is dynamic, what's permanent? The movement of molecules, the movement of atoms, the energy exchange, the fact that everything that what we're looking at is what we perceive is not all that is there. The world and everything around us and through us and us included is part of that dynamic. We give it certain attributes: life, living, death. We create connections. We have this sense of consciousness. We have constructed something that we call religion and faith and belief. And we base that on observation. Now we're left with being able to contemplate broader and broader pictures, broader and broader understanding of humanity. I guess that fits rather well with the commentary for today. Today's commentary is called Taking the Challenge of Freemasonry, Belief in Striving. So, for those of you who were told that the memory work doesn't matter, well, it does. It's old school. It's like sitting down to learn an instrument, knowing that practice makes you better. Makes you more accomplished, turns you, with enough diligence, 6,000 hours of practice can make you, turn you into a very, very good musician. That's been quantified. 6,000 hours of practice can turn you into a very, very good athlete, a singer, mathematician. So we can quantify all of this, but it's that desire that je ne sais quoi. What is it that creates the spark and desire in one and not in another? The human condition. Here's the challenge. Something about the challenge, though. Reconstructing ourselves into a better, improved version requires insight, dedication, and sacrifice. You have to want it. Enough with the search for meaning. Freemasonry gives us those phrases, but we need to articulate the process. What does one do with them? What is this process of transformation? What does it ask of me? Do I risk failure? The Freemasonry, Freemason in you, is never alone. but you are adrift in perilous seas. The risk is of failing yourself. So we embrace that fear of failure to drive us forward, learning as we go, to control, not ignore our emotion. Control of emotion isn't to erase it. We don't have that ability. But to understand what emotion is expressing about the world and around us and the environment right in front of us. So control isn't divorcing oneself from any one of that array of emotion, but embracing it. Of the many who want it, who practice hard, who put themselves out to be judged by strangers, who attend the audition facing failure, only the best on that day will be offered the lead. If your ego cannot learn from such failure, then you will never achieve your dreams. You will be stopped by your own hand. Freemasonry brings out an audacious side of the male character. Until we understand, we must be audacious. Trying, even though our inner voice is saying it is useless or lying to convince us, we can do whatever we strive to achieve. Life and reality are not like that. Freemasonry teaches us, in spite of the failures and hard knocks, we pick up and try again and again and again. And if we pay attention and seriously listen to ourselves, we will know whether we have potential, whether we have the potential to be in the chorus or to be first violin. If you strive like this, you are of Freemasonry. As enduring as a symphony. Part lyric, part performer. This is a little piece, beautiful. Try and imagine what Beethoven was thinking and trying to share with us. This Moonlight Sonata, Opus 27, number 2. Just play a little piece of this. This is by a pianist, Valentina Lisitsyna. Thank you. idea. Beethoven. Not without his critics, including people like me. Okay, how can I criticize something like that? Beautiful. I wanted to share with you every so often there's some material that comes across my desk that I find just staggering. And maybe you're a bit like me in some ways. Whenever I read something by a very renowned author that actually happens to agree with something that I've said or written about, I feel quite verified, affirmed. And this comes from this piece is not just about my conceits, the conceits of the Graham here, but I want to share with you something that I think is important. It's a bit long, but I think it is worth it. This is, and I'll credit this, as fully as I can. This comes from the workings of Ars Coratoro Coronatoro. This is volume 128, the premier research lodge of the world. And this is from the workings of the lodge from last year. This particular piece was presented in Lodge 13, November 2014. And it's called The Evolution of the English Lodge by Brother Gordon W.S. Davy, the past senior grand deacon, master of the Lodge of Ars Coratoro Coronatorum last year, just finished his year in office. Unlike Scottish lodges with a history including minute books going back to 1598, English lodges have no documentary evidence whatsoever regarding their existence until around 1700. According to old manuscripts in Grand Lodge, a properly constituted lodge must contain at least 5 members and a minimum of 1 brother who is active in the trade and is born out with the initiation of Elias Ashmole into a lodge in 1646. Elias Ashmole was made a Freemason at Warrington together with a Colonel Henry Manwaring. Excuse me, of course I'm going to start to choke up. My throat will go dry. I'll begin to sweat because I'm in conversation with all of you. My goodness. Perhaps a little something medicinal this time of the day would be helpful. I don't want to faint in front of my audience here. In addition, there were 7 lodge members present, including Mr. Richard Penkert, who's warden. The brethren and fellows present also included a Richard Ellum, who in his will in 1667 is described as a Freemason, who provided the oversight mentioned in the old charges. There was no organized Freemasonry as such, and we can only surmise as to the ceremony. In Warrington, the trade maintained its own organization, a guild which built with craft matters and welfare of its members. The local craftsmen and local masons appear to have encouraged the gentry to join the lodge associated with the guild. There is no reason to believe that it was any different for wherever there were masons' guilds. Once the secrets were imparted and the gentlemen had learnt the history and charges together with the signs and words, there was nothing to stop them setting up their own occasional lodges, so long as at least one working mason was present to act as an overseer. So it is no surprise that some 30 years later, Dr. Plott writes, "I find the custom spread more or less over all the nation. For here I found persons of the most eminent quality who did not disdain to be in this fellowship. When they are admitted, they call a meeting, which must consist of at least five or six ancients of the order, whom the candidates present with gloves, likewise to their wives. These were all occasional lodges, that is, lodges meeting at irregular intervals. When the four lodges meeting at the Goose and Gridiron formed the Grand Lodge of England, the moderns, in 1717, they introduced new concepts into the craft. Regular meeting dates, a central organization to regulate the craft, an annual feast, a structure with a grand master and grand officers, that is, a hierarchy, annual fees of membership, and lastly, the ability to visit other lodges to facilitate communication between members of lodges. It is not surprising, therefore, that many of the lodges which existed at that time joined this new organization. The ritual remained the same as before, a two-degree initiation, passing often done on the same day. This was the age of reason, and the meetings, apart from ceremonies, were to include lectures and dissertations from the lodge members. Ceremonies. Now remember, they met irregularly. The members of the Grand Lodge originally conceived that Freemasonry would become a learned society. The members of the Grand Lodge originally conceived that Freemasonry would become a learned society, almost a junior royal society. And in the years following, the members of the lodges who were engaged in the professions would give a lecture on improvements and current thoughts on their various subjects, including medicine, architecture, alchemy, and also architecture. Alchemy and architecture. Palladio and new ideas were also subjects for discussion. Palladio, P-A-L-L-A-D-I-O, gentlemen. This is exemplified in the minutes of Old King's Arms Lodge, which had been formed in 1725 as Lodge Number 25. This concept of Freemasonry as providing a place for self-improvement was very appealing while big changes in ideas and thought were taking place. But in the 1740s, members were less inclined to give and listen to these lectures, and Freemasonry was beginning to lose its appeal, as is shown by the declining lodge numbers and membership. In 1717, Freemasonry was a two-degree system which had changed from the 1730s to a three-degree one. The original ceremony was short, left plenty of time at meetings for lectures, and also the wining and dining, which loomed very large at large lodge meetings. From reading the minutes of various lodges in the 18th century, it can be seen that more is written about the cost and content of the food and drink than on the content of the meeting. Same as today. As interest in the philosophical component declined, something was needed to take its place. This was provided by the writing and promotion of the third degree. Originally, the third degree was not conferred in a regular lodge, where it was customary to work the first and second degrees, but was carried out in a master's or master mason's lodge, which had as its sole ceremonial the working of the third degree. This practice did not last long, perhaps because it involved additional expense. To get the third degree, the candidate had to join an additional lodge and pay a second set of dues. Many members didn't bother to take their third degree, particularly if they had no pretensions to grand rank. My own Lodge of Regularity number 91, founded in 1755, did not raise all its members, but in November 1790, it was decided to alter this, and no less than 15 members were raised to the third degree. Thus, by the time that competition arrived in 1751 with the formation of yet another Grand Lodge. The lodge was fairly standardized with three ceremonies and a short installation of the new worshipful master, with monthly or bimonthly meetings and annual or biannual changes in the master. Once every 2 years. On reading the minutes of meeting after meeting, one is always surprised how little the outside world affected the lodge. The main concern seemed to be wining, dining, and its costs, and moving from inn to inn as the meals and services altered. Lodges came and went. Occasionally charity is mentioned, but cost was king. The New Ancients Grand Lodge introduced a whole series of new ideas, with many additional degrees being worked in their lodges. The chivalric degrees, the royal arch, and indeed the lodge could perform any ceremony it liked. All this innovation and change should have destabilized the original concept, but it does not seem to have affected matters at the lodge level. While the rulers of the two organizations seem to be continually bickering and sniping at each other, matters at lodge level went on much as before. Problems about visiting other lodges was got round by the members of each constitution paying a fee to join the other. The Lodge of Regularity charged a fee of 5 shillings to make an ancient a modern. The major change was the popularity of the Royal Arch degree with both constitutions. Although the moderns, Grand Lodge, failed to recognize it as the fourth degree of the ancients, many modern Masons joined it, which culminated in the formation of the Grand Chapter of the Moderns, which had a separate secretariat to the moderns, Grand Lodge. The impact of the individual lodges of Grand Lodge seemed to be very small. When the first Freemasons' Hall was built by Thomas Stanby between 1775 and 1776, the money was raised partly through a tontine and partly through the selling of Masonic medals. Response was slow. By the beginning of the 1783, only 8 of the 104 lodges and 46 brethren were subscribing, including Somerset House Lodge, which gave £105, and the Old King's Arms, which donated £5, both of which met at the Freemasons Tavern, and the Lodge of Regularity, which gave £10.10. All of the lodges which donated were entitled to send an extra member to meetings of Grand Lodge in addition to their master and wardens. A few lodges met at the Freemasons Tavern in front of the hall. It is not part of my remit to discuss the union of the two Grand Lodges. I am only concerned with the consequences of the law for the lodges themselves. The amalgamation was accepted by the majority of the lodges of both Grand Lodges, although some still refused to accept the union and staggered on for a few years. The last one being the Grand Lodge of Wigan, formed in November 1821, which finally petered out in 1909. After the Napoleonic War, Great Britain was plunged into a recession, while the Combinations Act 1799 to 1800 affected attendance in the areas of the country which had large number of employees. This toxic combination resulted in the craft becoming the purview of the self-employed craftsmen, shopkeepers, and minor gentry, with a sprinkling of the aristocracy. An interesting way of putting it. The toxic combination resulted in the craft becoming the purview of the self-employed shopkeepers and minor gentry. In the early years of Queen Victoria's reign, there began a steady increase in lodges and lodge memberships. However, Freemasonry still had a low reputation, not quite respectable meeting in alehouses, the emphasis being on overindulgence. The notorious caricature of the drunken worshipful master being taken home by the tiler, painted by William Hogarth a century earlier, was how Freemasonry was still reviewed. Even the painter, William Hogarth, was a Mason. While we may complain, Hogarth was an eminent Mason and a past Grand Steward. So the perception of his caricatures did contain an element of truth, was how Masonry was perceived. When the London Lodges banded together to build the first Freemasons' Hall, it was placed at the rear of the site, and the two buildings fronting on Great Queen remained in situ, and permission was given to one of the buildings to sell liquors and coffee. It was called the Freemasons' Tavern and Coffee House. Over the years, the site was increased in size through the purchase of adjoining buildings, and extensive use was made of non-Masonic organizations of both the Freemasons' Hall and Freemasons' Tavern for meetings and functions, so much so that it was included in a publication, Illustrations of the Public Buildings of London. If one examines the lodges formed between 1850 and 1852, it can be seen that in the 1820s and 30s, about 100 new lodges were formed, both in the provinces and across the globe, not only in territories of the empire, but also in places like Brazil and Colombia. In the 1840s, as prosperity returned, the number of lodges increased by 150, and those no less than 62 were outside the British Isles, excluding Scotland and Ireland, which of course are different constitutions. Only 8 new lodges were formed in London. Gradually, the pace of growth of the English constitution was increasing. 268 lodges in the 1850s, 121 overseas, 21 in London, and the rest in the provinces. The 1860s saw 495 new lodges, 26 in London, 178 overseas, including in Smyrna, 3 in Constantinople, Yokohama, and also Argentina. The Prince of Wales, later Edward VII, as Grand Master, was a very gregarious man, and he entered into the duties of Grand Master with gusto. He attended stone laying galore, attended by large numbers of Freemasons. All these functions were reported in the press, and Freemasonry suddenly acquired respectability. The prince had been initiated by the King of Sweden at Stockholm in 1868 into the Swedish Rite, and had the rank of past Grand Master of England conferred upon him in 1870. He was installed as Most Worshipful Grand Master by the Earl of Carnarvon on the 28th of April, 1875, following the sudden and unexpected resignation of Lord Ripon. Freemasonry, with its connection to royalty, was becoming respectable and began to lose its not-quite-respectable aura. The fact that Freemasonry was newsworthy and reported in the press worked its way down, and local lodges were also reported upon. This added to its worth in the eyes of the general public. Prior to the building of the railways, lodges met near where their members lived. Indeed, there were a number of cases where the lodge meeting was held on the Wednesday nearest the full moon to allow the brethren to get home in the moonlight, as street lighting was unknown outside the metropolis until late in the 19th century. However, following the building of the railways, communications were much improved, and people could travel about much more easily. In the 1880s, following the construction of railways into Kent and the home counties, a number of lodges were formed by brethren residing in central London to meet in various towns in the home counties. Places such as Wilmington, deep in the fruit fields and apple and cherry orchards of Kent, became the home of Walsingham Lodge, number 2148. And similarly, Grove Park Lodge, number 2731 at Chestnut in Hertfordshire. In its early days, the members of Masonic Hall in Wilmington came down to Wilmington by train from Cannon Street or Blackfriars to Dartford on the South East London and Chatham Railway. The journey time to Dartford was 38 minutes. Grove Park Lodge number 2731 at Bushey in Hertfordshire stated in their petition in 1898 that a number of members were desirous of forming a new lodge in a pleasant rural area beyond the confines of London, but within easy reach of London. It chose Bushey in Hertfordshire, and the provincial Grand Master agreed to the lodge being consecrated. Their installation meeting was held by dispensation in London at the Liverpool Street Temple. To facilitate the comfort and convenience of the brethren and the railway, authorities provided a licensed saloon car on the 2:30 p.m. train to Hertfordshire and also on the 10:30 p.m. train to King's Cross. During the Second World War, the lodge met at O'Donino's Restaurant on Regent Street, London, from 1942 to 45. Masonic halls were being built where lodges could meet away from the public gaze, although most still met in hostelries, inns, and hotels and restaurants. Freemasonry was still growing in popularity, and in the decades from 1860 onwards, an average of 600 lodges a year were being formed, the only exceptions being the two post-war decades that saw 1,190 lodges in the 1920s and 1,127 in the 1940s. The 20th century saw lodges changing in character. No longer were they comprised of the local professional men, shopkeepers, and entrepreneurs. But there were also circumstances where members of a particular group of individuals got together to meet as a lodge. There were lodges for those involved in insurance and banking and manufacturing. School lodges, local council, and past masters lodges were very popular and proliferated about the country. The late 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s saw the formation of local lodges based upon areas along the arterial roads and the building of satellite communities around the main population. This was also a time when there was the depopulation of city and town centers. The 1980s saw a slowdown in the formation of new lodges when 430 were formed, and the 90s there were 345, and in the 2000s the pace slowed down even more. A new phenomenon appeared, the closure of lodges, which has risen in recent years to over 100 lodges a year. Recruitment in the lodges slowed down. Public interest in Freemasonry declined, as is shown by the removal of Masonic news from our national press. No longer did the Daily Telegraph and the Times carry reports on Grand Lodge meetings, and even in the provincial press it ceased to have newsworthiness. What caused this decline was well signposted over the years. Three main drivers of the decline were, and this is where Dale begins to smile, were the rise of feminism, which led to the demise of paternalism, and the increase in awareness of women that marriage was a partnership and not a master-servant relationship. Hear, hear. No longer was the wife to stay at home and look after the children. The second feature was the change in working patterns. The third and most important reason was the feminization of the workforce together with equal pay. How did this affect Masonry? One has to remember that Freemasonry is not cheap, and it is very difficult if one attends all lodge meetings and functions and subscribes to charity and visits to other lodges to spend less than £500 a year. What's that here? somewhere between $1,000 and $1,500. Although it can vary slightly more or slightly less, Freemasonry recruits only males, and normally men who are in the higher paid jobs. The man was now not the only breadwinner. The working wife made a contribution to the family finances and demanded a say in how the family money should be spent. Freemasonry to the wife was a luxury which could easily be stripped out of the family budget. Freemasonry depended on stability at work, in the home, and also in residence. A member belonged to a lodge, and relationships were built up over the years. In the late 20th century, there was a great increase in divorce, redundancy, and destroyed relationships. The home with divorce and marriage breakdown became less permanent, and employment was less structured, with the increased need for 7-day-week operations. Many of the activities and professions from which we used to recruit are no longer in existence. Small shopkeepers, independent practitioners, architects, estate agents, pharmacists, solicitors, accountants, and even bank managers. The list is endless. There is no one out there to recruit. Most people today are in employment in large companies, conglomerates, or public bodies such as healthcare, which alone has thousands and thousands and thousands of employees. These large organizations have a 24-hour business cycle, and that combined with a 7-day working environment means that many employees do not have a regular work pattern. So attending lodge meetings which work on a regular schedule is very, very difficult. The day of the town high street closing on Wednesday or Thursday afternoon has long since gone. The work pattern of the latter part of the 20th century thus reverted to a similar work pattern in the Victorian era, when there were fewer masons and fewer lodges. The other driver affecting people's leisure was the disappearance of the servant class and the emergence of the welfare and benefit system. So the jobs which in the past, which had been done by these people, had to be done by the individual, resulting in less leisure time for the members of the public who had become masons in the past. But the single most important reason, in my opinion, is the feminization of the workforce. This has resulted in a reduction by 50% of the number of individuals who are available for recruitment into Freemasonry. If one takes my own profession, pharmacy, with all its grades and layers, over 50% are female, and many are on job share to meet with their family commitments. And if, as in past, one recruited to Freemasonry 10% of pharmacists, the number we can recruit today compared with the past has sunk dramatically. These statistics are repeated in every profession, medicine, law, the clergy, with the inevitable result of fewer recruits for Freemasonry. We cannot change society. We can only respond. The various initiatives that Freemasonry has adopted over the last few years with retention teams and mentoring cannot in themselves increase recruitment or change the problems of society. What we have to do is examine our core values and decide how we can make Freemasonry a lifelong commitment, as it was in the past. Freemasons are told that one problem is that brethren do not remain Masons for life, but leave after a very short time in the craft. This is the nub. Why is this? Reasons given for leaving the craft include change in circumstance, divorce, redundancy, family hostility initiated in the wrong lodge, clash of personality in the lodge, not feeling part of the team, dislike of emphasis on giving money to charity, and always being asked for money. Several of these reasons are being dealt with by the mentoring and retention scheme. and I do not intend to comment on these, but the real problem can be stated as money. One of the weaknesses of the craft is the annual subscription, both to the lodge and to the central administration, and the need to pay annually for the privilege of belonging to the craft. If a member runs into financial difficulties, there is no provision for a member to put his membership into hibernation. The thinking is that if a member cannot afford it, then he should not be a member of the craft. If a member cannot pay up within the stated period, he is excluded either by the lodge or automatically after 2 years. This exclusion carries a stigma. Men join Freemasonry with high hopes and good intentions. They do not join with a view to renege on their obligations. Freemasonry makes great play of its caring nature and charitable giving. Can we not extend that to our own members? There are several classes of Freemasons who have to be considered. The elderly on a fixed or small pension. The young member who joined via the university scheme, comes out of university jobless with a student loan to pay off, and immediately his annual dues to Grand Lodge increase. Lastly, there are those who've been made redundant or those forced into early retirement at a greatly reduced income. Can Freemasonry respond to this challenge? What could we do to help? Apart from reducing costs and gradually reducing expenditure by the central authority, perhaps the craft could have a more humane method of dealing with money problems. Could we not create an associate membership with brethren who have fallen on hard times, having their debts frozen with a view to them adopting full membership with their when their circumstances allow? A similar concept is that in American rules football, where it is called as a timeout, the clock is stopped while a judgment is made or matters assessed. In this electronic age, they could receive electronically their lodge summonses and lodge minutes, and even provincial or metropolitan news. They will not have their masonry taken away, but put out into hibernation. This is no doubt a fanciful idea, but the penalty for not doing something to help is to lose them forever. We admitted them into the craft. Do we not have a duty of care? Do we have to desert them in their hour of need? Lest you think that I am totally pessimistic about Freemasonry, I do see some interesting things happening in the lodges and in the craft generally. Originally, lodges were based on the locality where you lived. Many of our lodges are still what could be termed local lodges, and it is often those who draw upon local people for their membership. This, I think, is still an area in which we can recruit. I have been noticing how the membership of these lodges has started to alter over the years. We have to remember that the country is not the country of the past. It is now multicultural. We're part of something new. Our candidates are candidates of the future. In visiting, many lodges are beginning to recruit newcomers to the country, first, second, and third generation. Candidates are joining the craft and seem to represent every community living in the area. Lodges not only have the Bible as a volume of sacred law, but also the Quran, the Gita, and Granth Sahib are seen more often in lodges. We are truly multinational, multi-religious, multi-ethnic, and tolerant organization, which has a lot to offer. And it seems to me that this is the future of the craft. list. How can you resist, really? Just a little something that I want to share with you about, just to give you some food for thought. I hope that the workings of the reading today was particularly provocative. I think Gordon Davey has something pertinent to say. The trends within Freemasonry echoes changes in the larger society. This is no place for reckless thinking. But something is incomplete in the order. And yes, we are an organization of aspiration, always moving forward. But for a long time, too long, we have been frozen in our place by the apparent confusion around us about what's going on. We hesitate to make change, to try and innovate, because we're not sure of the problem. But I think here's something that may, I think, embolden us a bit. This will be my closing commentary for today's show. Freemasonry has survived against all odds. It placed principles and ethics before politics and power, loved and loathed, and the failures of Freemasonry remain as challenges to the generations still searching. It began as explanations offered to the examination of life, showing the importance of the question to the pursuit of enlightenment. How, then, has a fraternal order, respectful of religion, libertines able to support the rule of law, been so influential for so long? In this paper, we talk about our critics, legitimate or otherwise. We talk with them about misogyny, homophobia, and even dare to consider what brought together disparate thinkers, urbane sophisticates, born of the gentry and the ambitious of nouveau riche. How did we make science, art, and philosophy into an order, a world voice, vox populi? Even today, small groups of men gather around the voice drawn by the ubiquitous journey in search of our bliss. I look forward to having you come back. We obviously need to talk. I need your advice. I can't possibly function like this without your assistance. Remember the words of Alexander Pope: the most positive men are the most credulous. Teach me to feel another's woe, to hide the fault I see, that mercy I to others show, that mercy show to me. How happy is the blameless vestal's lot, the world forgetting by the world forgot. Some people will never learn anything for this reason, because they understand everything too soon. I'll see ya. Here's a few tunes. Enjoy the rest of the year, and I'll see you next week. Here's a little Canada. Yeah.